I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. About 22% of the country's children are living in poverty right now on less than $23,550 for a family of four. And a sizable number of them live in what is called deep poverty on as little as half that amount of money. Philadelphia has has the highest poverty rate among big cities in the United States and one of the poorest districts in the country. The American Academy of Pediatrics has called on doctors to ask their young patients' caregivers a new question. Do you have difficulty making ends meet at the end of the month? That's because poverty is harmful to a young person's health with lifelong consequences. The head of the academy called poverty a chronic disease of children, the most chronic disease we have. And that's what we're going to talk about in this hour of Radio Times. We're joined by two pediatricians who work here in Philadelphia. Daniel Taylor is associate professor at Drexel University's College of Medicine, also director of community pediatrics and child advocacy at St. Christopher's Hospital for Children. And Daniel Taylor, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Roy Wade. He's an instructor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania and a pediatrician at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, Cobbs Creek Primary Care. He's also a Stoneley Foundation Fellow. And Roy Wade, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Pleasure to be here.
I kept reading about something in preparation for today's show called toxic stress. Can you describe that for us, Daniel?
Sure, I can. And Roy is an expert in that
Absolutely.
As well. Not that he had lots of toxic stress. I'm not too sure about that. But toxic stress is something that we're learning a lot more about in the past decade or so. Toxic stress is a type of stress that really has potentially early and lifelong consequences to kids. The stress response is there since, you know, the beginning of man and
the
woman.
Kind of fight flight.
Fight
right?
and flight. And it helps us with survival. And what's called tolerable stress is where you have a little bit of stress during the day, you have an exam, or maybe a dog's barking at you. It sends off certain hormones to help your body respond very quickly. And that's great. And that's how humans learn that something's good, something's bad, how to learn. But when that stress is constant, when that daily grind of things such as poverty, like we're talking about with this show, it has effects from the brain to the cardiovascular, to the endocrine, to the immune system, and even, unfortunately, into the genetic system, which we can talk about.
Absolutely. I mean, Roy, what we're talking about here is, we're talking about children being under a constant, set of stressful experiences, a sense of danger that they're somehow life is scary for them?
Yes. What we're talking about is individuals who experience just this prolonged activation of their stress response systems, this heightened levels of cortisol, heart rate, blood pressure, in response to external stressors that can occur either within their home or in their communities. And what we know is that if that occurs in the absence of a buffering and nurturing relationship with an adult, it can have those long-lasting ramifications that Dan mentioned before in terms of their development and the development of their brain, their behavior, and as the average childhood experience showed in association with physical health outcomes later in life.
Give us an example.
So what the adverse childhood experience study showed is that adults who had childhood experiences mostly within their homes, so things like abuse or neglect or household stress like domestic violence or substance abuse, those individuals, particularly those individuals who endorsed many of those experiences, were at increased risk for various health outcomes. Things that you already know are things like smoking and drinking and depression, but what an interesting finding from the study was that there's also a strong association with physical health outcomes. So things like cardiovascular disease, hypertension, high blood pressure, heart attacks, strokes, diabetes, cancer. One of the ACEs study even showed that individuals who endorsed six or more of these experiences, their life expectancy could decrease by as many as 20 years.
Let me read some of the questions. This is the ACE study. It's called the Adverse Child Experience Questionnaire. Here's the first one. Did a parent or other adult in the household often swear at you, insult you, put you down, or humiliate you, or act in a way that made you afraid that you might be physically hurt? Did an adult or person at least 5 years older than you ever touch or fondle you, or have you touch their body in a sexual way? Did you often feel that no one in your family loved you or thought you were important or special, or your family didn't look out for each other, feel close to each other, or support each other? This is just just there are 10 questions, and Daniel, these are just a couple of them. What does that tell us?
It tells us in the initial ACE study, which was done in San Diego, Kaiser Permanente, it was mostly middle upper class, mostly Caucasian people that were well educated, that even those individuals who we think
probably
pretty
much
highly okay, 12.6 of them had four or more adverse childhood experiences. And Dr. Wade and I will talk about why that number four or more is very important. Mm. And then also Dr. Wade is leading one of the ACE studies in Philadelphia to replicate what they did in Kaiser. And we know Philadelphia is much different than the population there. But I read something recently that it's what's called chronic unexpected toxic stress as well. It's this chronic, it's not knowing whether something's going to happen or not without that buffering, supportive, constant relationship. That's the kind of daily fear, the daily grind that does the damage. And we talk about how with those questions that your biography really affects your biology and how you interact both in infancy, childhood, teenhood, adulthood, and unfortunately, if you have lots of them, why people unfortunately die sometimes 20 years younger than those who don't have six or more adverse childhood experiences.
Roy, let me read just a couple of more. And again, this is while you were growing up during your first 18 years of life, was your mother or stepmother often pushed, grabbed, slapped, or had something thrown at her? Or sometimes or often kicked, bitten, hit with a fist, or hit with something hard? Or ever repeatedly hit over at least a few minutes or threatened with a gun or knife? Was a household member depressed or mentally ill? Or did a household member attempt suicide? Did a household member go to prison? I read these because I think it takes us into the lives of not just poor children, but I think just children in particular. But we're focusing on poor children. Would it be fair to say that more poor kids answer yes to these questions than more middle-class kids?
Well, much of the studies suggest that those family stressors are at least found more commonly in economically distressed settings. And I emphasize the word found because there's a heightened surveillance amongst economically distressed families as well. So we're not clear, you know, whether or not we're just looking more. But one point that I want to highlight is that, you know, coming here as a pediatrician, one thing I was finding and thinking about the ACEs study was that those family level stressors were not the only stressors that my kids were encountering. They were encountering daily stressors within their community. So things like community violence, exposure to discrimination, racism, bullying, and these are all experiences that we know are associated with poor health outcomes for kids, but were not included in the initial ACEs study. And so the part of the work that we did in the task force is really in thinking about taking this work and adopting it here in Philadelphia, do we need to be asking about these broader experiences that occur within these kids' neighborhoods as well?
I've heard some people describe kids growing up in some of these neighborhoods as living in a war zone. I don't know if that's correct or not. And I don't know if that's even helpful or not. Daniel?
And I don't think that's helpful at all, just because it almost is this nihilistic kind of thought process where you can't get out.
It's hopeless, right?
The war is always there. We have a war on poverty that luckily the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Academic Pediatric Association, now April 2016 put out two guidelines and policy statements saying this is the most important non-communicable disease that we've ever seen in pediatrics is addressing childhood poverty. This is it. And to relate what Roy was saying about poverty and adverse childhood experiences, with the Philadelphia ACE Task Force, they've looked at areas where there are four more adverse childhood experiences in adults, and you overlay the same map of concentrated areas of poverty, and the areas of concentrated areas of poverty have the most adverse childhood experiences, four more adverse childhood experiences. Okay.
So it's time to think of poverty as a disease.
That's
more helpful than thinking of war zones and things like that.
Absolutely.
And a disease that has physical consequences, emotional consequences.
Well, you know, it wasn't long ago, right? Before, you know, when people were saying, well, you know, kids who live in poverty, that's just transient for them. They don't remember these experiences and they don't impact them long term. I think what the ACEs study and other studies are showing is that that's actually not the case. That kids who experience particularly extreme poverty, because they're in part exposed to these traumatic events, are at increased risk for poor health outcomes later in life, just by, you know, by virtue of the fact that they had these experiences.
There's some effects or potential impacts even on a developing brain.
Right.
Can you expand on that?
So what we know is that kids, particularly if these experiences occur early in life, and we think about this window as being between the ages of 0 and 6, and that's malleable for different people, but in general, I think the consensus is about between the ages of 0 and 6, that kids, if they have these experiences, particularly a number of these experiences, there are certain areas in their brain that can govern your executive functioning skills. So how you plan your day, your ability to regulate your emotions and make attachments, and even govern your stress response systems that actually are altered or changed as a result of exposure to these experiences. The areas that control your executive functioning skills, your ability to plan your day and your attachment and your ability to regulate your emotions become impaired. And the areas that oversee your fight or flight response, your ability to respond appropriately to extremely stressful situations, they actually become heightened. They become overactive. And what you tend to see is, particularly in kids who have been traumatized, is that they over-respond to even situations that others might deem not stressful at all. And that's in part because of that trauma.
Overreacting, meaning through aggression, something like that?
Or through acting out or in their behavior. I mean, these may be kids who you see on the street who, who are experiencing a routine stressor that we might perceive, who may be yelling, shouting, screaming, or if you're a customer service representative, these are individuals who, you know, with the slightest level of, inconvenience may tend to yell or be angry in such situations. And the reason why I highlight that point is because it really takes you, our tendency typically in our society is to label that person as a bad person, right? And what the power of this ACEs work and this toxic stress work is really says it's not really that person that bad. It's the environment that they've come from and the bad experiences that they might have had.
Does it help to explain why a certain proportion of low-income kids struggle in school? Does it help explain perhaps the achievement gap?
I think it does tremendously. I mean, I saw one study recently that fourth grader reading levels in the public schools in Philadelphia, only 14% of kids in fourth grade, these are 9-year-olds, are at reading level in public schools. I also saw a recent study that showed we're at the levels of segregation in the public school systems around America, not just Philadelphia, that are the worst since Brown versus Board of Education. So extremely impoverished communities with extremely impoverished schools with lots of segregation that contributes to it. But what Roy was talking about, just tracing back a little bit, is it's that window of opportunity. Again, kids after 6 years of age, they can, they're malleable, but not they're not like that new form clay that you can kind of alter really well at birth at 1 month of age. That time is so important. And the areas of the brain that are really affected by toxic stress, besides those with executive functioning, is an area in the deep brain. It's called the hippocampus and the amygdala. Those are responsible for learning.
I want to pick up on a bunch of things that you both just said. That's Daniel Taylor joining us with Roy Wade. They are pediatricians here in Philadelphia working with poor families, with poor children, and talking about toxic stress and its impact on a young person's development. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and if you're just joining us, let me just recap here. More than 16 million children, almost a quarter of the population of children in this country, live in poverty, putting them at risk for chronic diseases, for learning problems, because of something called toxic stress, how the brain and the body react to trauma and danger. The American Academy of Pediatrics recently called on pediatricians to do a better job screening for poverty and talking with poor children and their caregivers about their lives. And again, our guests are Daniel Taylor, associate professor at Drexel University College of Medicine, director of community pediatrics and child advocacy at St. Christopher's Hospital for Children. And Roy Wade is an instructor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania and a pediatrician at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, Cobbs Creek Primary Care. And again, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I wonder, too, about just the sort of emotional or even psychological development, that if a young child, a 4 or 5 year old, feels that they are in a stressful environment, whether it's inside the house or the apartment with the family or outside in the neighborhood, what happens to their worldview? And Daniel, let me toss that first to you, but Roy, I'd like to hear from you as well.
You know, obviously I can't speak for each individual child or neighborhood or, you know, block. But we do know that what toxic stress does to, you know, the developing brain, and I touched on it before the break, that it does affect certain areas of the brain that are responsible for memory, that are responsible for the fight or flight mechanism, where especially a deep portion of the brain called the amygdala, which in several studies now over the past 2 years have shown to be affected via MRI studies, hypertrophied bigger, meaning it's stimulated all the time. That's the accelerator of the brain. These kids are constantly on the accelerator, like in a car, constantly revved, that anything, a sudden sound, you see it, immunization that we're about to give. We see some kids in our practices when they're about to get a shot, they flip out and they can't help it sometimes, and that's almost a red flag that that child might be having some sort of adversity in their household. They just can't stop that accelerator. They have no control sometimes.
And I was wondering too, Roy, maybe it's not so much brain, or perhaps it is related to the brain, but just the sense of feeling safe and feeling that you can trust the people in your world. How does that play out?
Yeah, and what we know, particularly from research along trauma theory, is that individuals who've had these traumatic experiences, particularly in early in life, their ability to connect with people and their attachment becomes impaired as well. These individuals are less likely to be able to connect with friends and adults who might be supportive and actually buffering and nurturing to help them, to help mitigate the impact of these experiences. We know that that it can create this distrust with individuals. One of the things I'm always concerned about with my kids is that, or kids who I know who have had a lot of these experiences, is that they also tend to internalize them. They tend to blame themselves for these experiences, and their behavior and their coping strategies tend to fall from that. And one of the key interventions, I think, is really how do you help kids rationalize these experiences, externalize them, put them on the individuals who did them to them, and not blame themselves and say, I deserve these experiences.
Which is really reshifting how they think about themselves and, I guess, the world that they live in. I was interested in this American Academy of Pediatrics saying that it's important not to say to a child, what's wrong with you, to say to them, what happened to you?
Exactly.
And that's such a subtle but important distinction. Right. How do you see that?
Well, I think it's important. And let's take it as an example, right? So you have a kid who has been traumatized and has significant issues in his family. And he goes to school and he has behavioral problems. And it's actually not uncommon for me to see this in primary care. And what tends to happen, or what can happen at least, is that we as adults or teachers in this kid's life may say, well, that's a bad kid, right? And understanding how ACEs or trauma impacts brain development and what are some of the outcomes because of that really shifts the conversation, right? It moves you to this is, as I was saying before, not a bad kid, right? But bad things have happened to this kid. And it really helps us in terms of building interventions, right? We know that this kid's been traumatized, and we can develop trauma-focused interventions to help this kid to deal with those past events and move forward and become successful.
You want to add to that? Go ahead,
Jane. Yeah, I think what we're seeing, and like what we are seeing in Flint, Michigan, right now with the lead poisoning issue there, is, okay, lead is something we can test for. It comes from the blood. We know the toxic effects for the brain of lead, but then also what we're learning with Flint is just like Philadelphia, it has an incredible amount of concentrated areas of poverty, and the interventions need to look at some of the interventions that Roy and I will talk about later for the poverty, not the lead as well, but the poverty. But if we had something, and we're starting to get that now, where you can test the stress levels, what's called the cortisol levels, which we can do. It's just not standard of care right now. Would we be able to convince policymakers, parents, teachers, this kid has an elevated cortisol level because of this? Now we need to teach, to understand, to do everything around those levels. Just like if we're not going to blame a kid who had a lead level of 40, we shouldn't blame a child who had a cortisol level of 30.
Roy, you want to add something? Go ahead.
Marty, I just wanted to follow up on that really quickly. Just early on in our conversation, because I know your audience is listening, I want to make sure that they understand that none of this is set in stone, right? And so
that was my next question.
Not
yes.
Everyone individual who has lived in extreme poverty or been exposed to adverse conditions has gone on to have a bad life. In fact, I'm sure we could all name several individuals who have had really difficult childhoods who've gone on to do great things in life. I think the key learning point from that is that when anecdotally, when you talk with these individuals and they tell you about what made the difference for them in their lives, they often cite a relationship with a caring and supportive adult, right? And I want to highlight the fact that I said adult. I didn't say parent.
Right.
So that means that any individual within your community who cares about kids, any adult within your community who cares about kids can actually be this sort of nurturing and buffering person. And this is actually supported by research. If someone comes up to me and asks me, well, Roy, you're a researcher on adversity and, what really works? What I know, the evidence, shows is that what consistently works to help to mitigate the impact of these experiences is having this consistent and caring relationship with a loving adult.
And does that change things like the cortisol levels, and even what has been happening to the brain under this toxic stress?
That's a great question. And actually, there was a study just last year in JAMA Pediatrics in 2015 that actually looked at the size of children's brain between 3 and 6 years of age in St. Louis, did MRI studies of children's brains and looked at the poverty levels. And, unfortunately, in the children who lived in this constant grind of childhood poverty, had smaller areas of the brain that were responsible for memory, responsible for connections with adults, responsible for executive functioning. But the one buffer, the one thing that protected the brain was that caring, supportive adult. So much so that now, knowing this, just to bring it back to what we see every day at a family yesterday, single mom, dad away, which we all know means away, who I asked, is there somebody who is taking over, is working with the kids, who is this positive role model for these four boys?
What was the answer?
And the answer was, yeah, my brother. I won't say his name because of HIPAA laws, but my brother, and I wrote down the brother's name in the chart. This is an intervention. This Uncle Blank is in their life, and every time I see these boys now, I ask about not just how mom's doing, how the boys are doing, but how Uncle Blank is doing, because that person, I know, if he's doing what we're talking about, is protecting these kids' brain, is protecting their health, is protecting their coronary arteries, their adrenal glands, other things that can affect the long-term health of these children.
And I guess when you think about things like diabetes or heart disease or longevity, I mean, that's in specifics, in many ways, poverty puts you at risk for that.
Right, right. And so one of the things that has been concerning for me is that when we think about trauma, right, we typically thought about this in terms of those family level experiences. And one of the, I think, interesting pieces of the ACEs work is that it doesn't ask you about how many times those experiences happen. It just puts it into a core score, right? And based on your score between 0 and 10, right, they show this increasing association as your score, as an individual's score increases. But our concern here in Philadelphia when we started the Philadelphia ACE Task Force was really about, all those additional experiences that are not being included in this and how do they impact outcomes. One of the things we found, so we replicated the Philadelphia ACE study, we replicated the ACE study here in Philadelphia, surveying adults throughout the city and asking them about their ACEs and their health status.
Right.
And one of the things we found that was interesting was that initially there was a lot of pushback, and people said, well, asking about the family level events is the same thing as asking about these neighborhood stressors as well. The same people who endorse these family events are going to be the same people who endorse, being exposed to violence within their community. And we found that there was a lot of overlap. About 50% of the respondents who said they experienced family stress growing up also had neighborhood stress growing up. But we found that 1 out of 8 respondents, about 14%, said they had high levels of neighborhood stress and had no family stress.
Oh, that's interesting.
So it means that if you didn't broaden the assessment, you may miss individuals who may be experiencing significant adversity nonetheless.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Roy Wade, also with us, Daniel Taylor. They are both pediatricians here in Philadelphia, working in low-income parts of the city, dealing with poor children and their families and their caregivers. And you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Daniel, let me just toss you something. Roy, you might want to weigh in on this as well. So let's say we had a living wage. Say we had earned income tax credit that was applied more effectively. We gave poor people more money. Would this address some of the stresses we've been talking about?
Yes.
Yes, and the short answer being,
you know, the science is out there, and there was actually just an article that came out in a journal called Health Affairs. And it's what we call this healthcare paradox that we have in the United States, state-by-state healthcare paradox as well. And what that showed is that those states that spend more money on social services like minimum wage, earned income tax credit, benefits for nutrition, home visiting programs, those kind of things that we know work, the outcomes, the health outcomes of adults are better in those states that spend more on social services. That's not new news for worldwide, because we know that other countries that spend a lot more on social services have better health outcomes than those that we have in the United States as well. So now they're showing that state by state level, the more we spend on social services, the more we can protect, especially these younger kids, the better health outcome we'll have.
And the more money we'll save. I remember reading before we had Medicare and Social Security for older people in this country, that the poverty rate for senior citizens was just astronomical. That has been reduced as a result of a bunch of different things, including, in many ways, Social Security and Medicare. Can we draw from that, Roy, and apply this to children?
Yeah, I want to take us a step further, though. So we talked about, you know, earned income tax credit and other sort of support services, but also including things like home visiting programs and Head Start programs and quality preschool programs. Those are also have been shown to actually have impact and improve outcomes, particularly for the, you know, the populations that we're talking about. There's one concern with that, though. There's a recent study, I think it was published back in 2013 by Bob Whitaker here in Temple, where he surveyed across the state Head Start staff and asked them about their ACEs. Right? And what he found was that about 23% of the respondents had an ACE score of 3 or more, right? Meaning that they have been significantly impacted by childhood trauma. And so the reason why I bring that up is that we know that's probably higher here in the city of Philadelphia, because many of the staff that, you know, support Head Start programs and preschool programs come from the communities that they're serving. And it's difficult to be able to help a child who's been traumatized and had a difficult upbringing if you yourself have been impacted by trauma as well. And so it calls for the need for programs and services around professional development that are trauma-informed and helping actually staff who have been impacted by trauma.
It's a perfect time to bring in David from Flemington. David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you. Just a question. Is our mental health system currently equipped to deal with the types of complex childhood problems the physicians are describing that apparently affect millions of children? Thank you.
You're welcome. I guess we're all pointing at you, Roy. Go ahead.
I would say here in Philadelphia, we're probably leading the way, you know, with our Commissioner Arthur Evans, and we have many of the leading experts in terms of childhood trauma, individuals like Steve Berkowitz at Penn and CHOP, who have really, you know, developed interventions that are targeted towards families and children who have been traumatized. About 3 years ago, we received a grant, I believe, from the Office of Mental Health. I'm not certain, but that encouraged or helped several of our community-based organizations come together and form a group of agencies called PACT. That and their primary focus was to build in trauma assessment to their practice and use evidence-based interventions like trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy to improve outcomes for kids who have been traumatized and have behavioral health issues.
It looks like you want to say something, Dan.
Yeah, that's very much correct. Children's Crisis Treatment Center leading the charge as well. But what we need to do is really just take our healthcare system and just turn it upside down and not make our families go to different resources, go to different healthcare agencies and different behavioral health organizations, but to have it within our own practice, to have co-located mental health services so that that child could be seen by their pediatrician and their therapist the same day with a psychiatrist if needed, also on site. So co-location is so important, and that's the way we really need to kind of move, especially mental health care in the pediatric offices.
I'm sure some people are thinking, and frankly, it's crossed my mind as well, which is that poverty is an intractable problem. And certainly the recession has made the problem even more more serious. Mm-hmm. I know that's not helpful thinking, mm-hmm. but I'm sure a lot of people listening saying, we had this war on poverty, we still have this high rate of poverty.
We had this war on poverty, yeah. And unfortunately, those like Bernard Dreyer, who's the president of the American Academy of Pediatrics, who helped write the policy statement, I've heard him say, unfortunately, we're losing it for children. You did mention that those adults who are 65 and older, rates of adult poverty is down to about 9%. Mm-hmm. But those for children, like you mentioned, it's about a quarter of all children in the United States live in poverty. And unfortunately, the children under 5 years of age with the developing bodies are those most affected. And 39% of kids in Philadelphia, 135,000 kids in Philadelphia live in poverty right now.
Wow. Well, anything, we're almost having a break, but go ahead, Roy.
Well, I do agree with Dan that to some degree we are losing that war in terms of children. But thinking positively also, we are, with our science, beginning to understand more and more about the myriad different ways in which poverty affects the health of kids. And as a result of that, we can design our services and support systems to be prepared for those experiences so that even if we can never get our act together on the federal level, right, to really work to decrease poverty, that we can actually improve outcomes nonetheless for those kids by the ways and by changing the ways in which we serve this population.
We're talking about childhood poverty in this country, and that's Roy Wade. He's a pediatrician at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, Cobbs Creek Primary Care, also a Stoneleaf Foundation Fellow. And Daniel Taylor is also a the Director of Community Pediatrics and Child Advocacy at St. Christopher's Hospital for Children. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Let me get some callers in on the conversation. We have Mickey calling us from Germantown. Mickey, go ahead. You're on the air.
I'm calling actually to complain or to be concerned that people act like it's imperialism, that everything is a subset of medicine and health. That I think that really excludes and disrespects public servants, teachers, social workers, people active in their church, people active on their block, and that it ends up acting like doctors or other medical authorities are the only ones with expertise.
Yeah, Mickey, I don't want you to go away with that impression at all, and I don't think either of my guests do. They're both waving their hands at me, Daniel Taylor,
so,
and then you,
Mickey,
Roy Wade.
I apologize so much if we are coming across that way. Not at all. When I went to medical school a long time ago, we thought that the genetic code was so important, and we now know it's more the zip code. It's people who live in the zip code. It's the parents looking for the assets of that parent or the parent unit. That asset's the block leader, the church pastor, the rabbi, the imam. Those people, Dr. Wade and I know, are much more important than he or I sitting here in terms of the outcome of that child. And we want to work so closely with every individual community-based organization to help the children that we serve. And I'm so sorry if we came across that way.
You want to add to that, Roy?
Absolutely. I agree. I think that's really the focus of the work that I'm doing here in Philadelphia. Is really built on this idea that the answers lie and the solutions actually lie in the community. If I can, I'd like to tell a story that really supports that. So when I first came here to Philadelphia as a fellow, I did a study just to understand how people who lived in the city, who grew up in the city, actually conceptualized adversity and what's the language that they used. And so I held a series of focus groups at young adults between the ages of 18 and 26 and just asking them that question. What were the traumatic experiences that you had growing up? And give me the language that you used to describe them. And I held a focus group with two young women. It's not ideal, but these young women, when they came in, they actually brought their kids as well, and so we actually have to have daycare on the side to help them while we were doing the focus groups. And much of their adversity was around feeling marginalized and devalued as a woman. You know, so many of their male counterparts were unfortunately incarcerated or had passed away, and it was such that the women, or their mothers, felt like they could do no right. And their cousins and their males could do no wrong, right? And so at the end of the focus group, one of the things they asked me was, well, tell me why you're holding these. And you know, we talked about the adverse childhood experience study, and we got deep into resiliency and protective factors. And on their own, without any prompting from me, what they did was they started to count up their mom's A score. And they started to say, well, that may explain why my mom might have behaved that way to me. But probably the more powerful piece is that their kids were over playing with our, you know, with our help, and they looked at their kids and they said, you know, that actually might explain why I do this with my kid, and they came up with their own ways to be more buffering and supportive for their kids, to help to nurture them and to prevent their exposure to adversity or at least mitigate the impact of it.
I mean, there are many lessons there. One is that you ask them. You know, and listen to what they had to say.
And so I think key for doing this work is really respecting the agency and the efficacy and the ability of folks in the community to really address this issue. And what they need is the information and the support to build the interventions that I think will work.
You wanted to talk, Daniel, about just the cost of childhood poverty in this country.
Right. A couple studies recently looked at the cost of childhood poverty in the United States, and the estimates are about 4% of gross domestic product can be associated with the effects of untreated now childhood poverty, about $500 billion annually.
Wow.
4% of gross
billion
dollars annually. And that's, you know, the dollars we do know, and there's lots of research, not in the medical field, but in the economic field, that if you invest early on and if you invest in that kind of ball of clay, that newborn, that early kind of brain development, for every dollar you invest, the payout is $10, $17 in saved costs later on. But once you get to be about, unfortunately, around 6 or 7 years of age, there's diminishing cost returns.
Can I follow up on that?
Yes, please.
So just to follow up on what Dan said, one of the concerns, though, with the ACEs work is that a lot of our focus is really on early child development. And that's, I think, clear. I think that's where you get the biggest bang for your buck. But I have a mentor, Ken Ginsberg at CHOP. I'll never say it as articulately as he can say it. But, one of the fears is that we're going to forget about the teenagers and the folks who have been significantly impacted by ACEs. And they're not as cute anymore. And you know, they may act in ways that, you know, we don't necessarily approve of. And so we don't, you know, direct and target our services, right? But we can improve outcomes for these kids nonetheless. A lot of the work suggests, once again, getting back to what we already know, that connection with a caring adult in their life can actually mitigate these experiences, even for teenagers who've been trauma impacted. The other research that's been done has been looking at cognition, and there's been several studies that show that kids who have been impacted by early childhood trauma, their IQ scores can decrease. A lot of the initial research focused on trying to improve their IQ scores, but what we really found out is that if you can just improve their executive functioning skills, get them to show up to class on time, to be willing to raise their hand and ask questions, to engage with their professors and their teachers and their colleagues, that you can really improve the needle and improve outcomes for them by focusing on those areas.
We've been talking a lot about this Adverse Child Experience Questionnaire, ACE. We will make sure to post that on our Facebook page so people can look at it specifically. Let me just read a couple of comments. A tweet from Samantha. Listening to the questions from the ACE you read on the survey, it seems not just poor kids would answer yes. A comment from David. Toxic stress isn't unique to poor children. Fair. I mean, we've been focusing largely on poor children. Do they deal with more stress than other children, or does it vary family to family?
The research does show that if you live in poverty, you have more likelihood of having adverse child experiences, but that does not diminish the fact that many middle, upper-income children and then they become adults. You know, the child is the father of man later on. That from the initial ACE study in San Diego, right. It showed that 12.6% of middle, upper-class families had these adverse child experiences. And by having those adverse child experiences, you were, for example, 1.7 times higher risk of having a heart attack or a stroke as an adult, stuff like that.
Does it also explain generational poverty to some degree, do you think?
Can I answer both of those questions?
Yeah, you can.
I want to follow up with that.
I
think that's part of the strength of the initial ACEs study, because one of the concerns that I've had, because my focus is on poverty and how ACEs impacts kids who are in poverty. But there's a concern that this issue can then get marginalized to an issue of poor people, right? And one of the powers of the initial ACEs study was that it was in a, you know, mostly middle to upper middle class population. Right. The other issue is that what we found in the Philadelphia ACEs study, so our replication of the initial adverse childhood experience study here in our city, was that the difference was not in whether or not you would endorse an ACE, right? And so when we looked at the prevalence of individuals across this across our study who endorsed at least one adverse childhood experience, is about equivalent, about 60-something percent, to the folks in the initial Kaiser study. What we found the difference was in significant adversity. And so, as we said before, there's this increasing risk for poor health outcomes as your ACE score increases. But where you really start to see that your risk take off is when you endorse multiple experiences, like four or more of these experiences. And what we found was that in our study, as Dan cited, in the initial Kaiser CDC study, about 12.5% of the respondents endorsed four or more ACEs. In our study, about 20% of respondents endorsed four or more ACEs. And so let's extrapolate that out. That's 1.5 million people. So in this city, if our study holds true, that's about 300,000 people with an ACE score of four or more, right? And so that's really powerful information.
Let me read one more, and this is again from this ACEs study. This is number six. Were your parents ever separated or divorced? And we know how common that is, and it's not always harmful for children, but it certainly creates stress within the family, and certainly
that's
for children.
That's interesting. I'm going to send it over to Roy in a sec, because I know
what he's going to say. Yeah, okay.
But this is where, in the Kaiser study, this was probably a huge issue for many of the children that became adults. But in Philadelphia, from I've learned from Dr. Reid, go ahead, Roy.
So with my mentor, Christopher Forrest, at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, we've really been trying to delve into deep and really to understand and appropriately conceptualize what adversity means, right, particularly for kids here in Philadelphia. We've been looking at national data sets that are done by the CDC since this initial ACE study that have been surveying across states. And one of the things we found is that the divorce or separation question is actually not one of the more impactful adversities within it. And there's several reasons why, right? Because divorce or separation actually can be a protective factor if you're within a relationship or where there is abuse in the home or domestic violence in the home. The other information is, so as I said before, I did a qualitative study to try to understand how young adults here who grew up in Philadelphia conceptualize adversity, how they describe these experiences, and we held these focus groups. And what we found was that they said many of the initial ACEs, particularly things like domestic violence in the home, substance abuse in the home, but instead of saying divorce or separation, what they said was single-parent homes. And this is actually their exact words. This is not Roy Wade's interpretation. These were exact words. And we actually pushed back. We said, well, why didn't you guys say divorce or separation? And what they said was that so many of our families start off as single-parent homes that the concept of divorce and separation is actually something that's relatively foreign to us. Yeah. It's not that they're not intelligent, right? And if you ask them a question about divorce and separation, they can respond to it. But what we know from research is that the engagement, right, of the respondent to your questionnaire or survey increases if they can see their life experience framed within your questions, such that their authenticity or the validity, the accuracy of their responses increases because they think that you're asking them questions about their real life. So what I'm telling you is that you can actually improve your ability to identify kids who have experienced significant adversity just by going to them and asking them how do they describe these experiences using their language.
Words matter, right? Let me get Joseph from Ardmore to join us. Hi, Joseph. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
First of all, I just want to ask the two panelists, how often do you get in this question of nurture versus nature? That caller who asked about why are the everything being steered towards medical science side versus social worker side, the answer I heard is it's both. That argument is wasting of time and energy and resources. Second thing I really want to ask the doctors were that I'm so glad that the science is coming into it. because we social workers, psychologists have been beating our heads against this issue for 40, 50 years, but we're not making much progress. And recent research that I read from the Karolinska Institute on brain development, they described in a book called Growing Brain that between birth to age 2, it's when all the axons are built and the myelination occurs. And at age 2, the thing slows down. There's an old idea that you could not do that again later because of lack of flexibility and neuroplasticity.
You know, Joseph, I'm going to just jump in here only because it's not the greatest phone line, and I do want to – we're talking – I believe the sort of heart of your question is this stuff hardwired, and is it – can it change over time?
I think he asked two things very quickly that we know in America – this is all of America – about 60 to 70% of health in America is social in origin, what we call the social determinants of health. 30% of what I learned 2 decades ago in medical school – helps some. It's right. The 60 to 70% that we really need to work on. And as hopefully we've talked about a little bit, that the brain is plastic through the teenage years, young adult years. It's a little more difficult, but it definitely can change. We just have to get people to see their own assets and to kind of work with those.
We did a show earlier this week about the soda tax or the sugary drink tax, and we have a email question about that. Do these doctors think that the proposed soda tax would exacerbate or improve poverty, resulting in health effects that they're describing? And as we know, you know, sugary drinks have a lot of sugar in them. Have you looked at that, Roy Wade?
Not directly, but, you know, so I'm not as familiar with the nuances of the current proposal as is. Some of the things that I've heard is that they may potentially exacerbate problems for – it's a regressive tax, so it may potentially exacerbate problems for low-income people because they tend to purchase more of these right. beverages. But I think in the end, what's important is that all of our interventions, all of our policies really need to be trauma-informed, right? With this new research, with this new understanding of how stress and how poverty can create increased stress within families and increase the likelihood that kids who are living in these families are exposed to toxic stress. That means that any new proposal that comes through, we need to be thinking about this with the trauma-informed lens.
We're almost out of time here. One of the things, Daniel, I should say to our listeners, you write occasionally for the Philadelphia Inquirer. You talked about the different life expectancies here in Philadelphia. Can you expand on that?
Right. And this is a great moment because right now Robert Wood Johnson Foundation funded a study through Virginia Commonwealth University that looked at several cities in the United States, Philadelphia being one of them, and looking at life expectancies in various zip codes in Philadelphia as a couple of other cities as well. And what it showed is in places, especially where I work and where Roy works, where there's lots of adversity, where there's lots of poverty, such as Swamp Poodle, Strawberry Mansion, Fairhill, the life expectancy there was around 68, 69 years of age. If you go 3.5 miles away to other areas of the city, Society Hill, Chestnut Hill, that's 20 years more, 87 years. So that 20 years difference in life expectancy we saw 15 years ago in the initial ACE study that looked at those families that had 6 or more adverse child experiences were more likely to die 20 years younger. So we're still dealing with it, and we have to work on it as an entire city and community. That's the only way.
Looks like you want to say something, Roy. Just 10, 15 seconds.
15 seconds.
Yeah, sorry about that.
So just in thinking about this nurture versus nature issue, I would say both, right? I think my major concern is that when I was a resident, we were training people that the differences between health outcomes between races was due to genetics or behavior. And what the ACEs study is showing us is that the environment is playing a significant factor as well.
Well, we could go on. I wish we could. My thanks to both of you for joining us and for the work that you're doing as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Roy Wade is a pediatrician at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, Cobbs Creek Primary Care. Also a Stoneleigh Foundation Fellow. Daniel Taylor is the Director of Community Pediatrics and Child Advocacy at St. Christopher's Hospital for Children. And again, we will post this ACE questionnaire on our Facebook page. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.